Sometimes we might overreach ourselves, but you know, you've got to admire those who try. You've got to just stretch. If you aim for the stars, you may not get them, but if you at least won't get a handful of mud either. Better to reach further. As a missionary who for 38 years has concentrated on serving persecuted Christians in restricted access areas, I've travelled in 42 countries and I've worked in 38 countries across four continents, and I've been involved in 8 wars and 3 revolutions. This included throughout Eastern Europe behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War. The Iron Curtain was the dominant reality from 1945 to 1989. And for a good part of my life, this was the reality. All these countries that have been betrayed to Stalin's Soviet Union by the Western Allies in the name of fighting for democracy at the end of the Second World War. And all these countries betrayed to the Soviet Union, and they were having their troops occupying and oppressing and exploiting and persecuting people. In, we talk about 150 million Christians in 10 nations betrayed to the Soviet Union in the Yalta Agreement alone. And so Europe was divided between slave and free. Communism was the reality for our friends in Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, East Germany, Hungary, Romania, Yugoslavia, Albania. And just to go into Eastern Europe, it would take about 3 to 5 hours at the border post seeking to smuggle in. When I went into Romania, you'd see the pictures of Ceausescu everywhere, the Marxist flags and emperor worship, like hadn't been seen since the time of the Caesars. Every home, every business, every church, everywhere had to have a picture of El Presidente, of dictator Ceausescu. May Day was a major religious event, marching under the red flags, and you can see here the religious nature of communism. There's the red star with Lenin's face in it. Notice it isn't just communist countries' flags here. You can actually see not just Bulgaria and North Korea, East Germany, but India. India's not communist. What are they doing? And you'll see further forward, there's the, over here you can see Norway's flag. They're not communist. Chile, what are they doing there? Austria, Italy, Spain. But communism was a missionary religion seeking to take the whole world, You have a world to win. And on May Day, you also saw some things that broke with the narrative. Because according to the narrative at that time, there was Yugoslavia was an independent country, it wasn't part of the Soviet Warsaw Pact, but in fact Yugoslavia was always part of the Warsaw Pact. And North Korea and China were also meant to be separate, but there's Red China and North Korea being celebrated in Budapest, in Hungary, in May Day. So this Sino-Soviet split and Yugoslavia being head of the non-aligned nations was just basically a tactical deception. Albania, the most atheist country in the world. They killed the last minister. They destroyed the last church. It wasn't a single church, mosque, synagogue, nothing religious in the whole of Albania. They had big jamming stations to make sure no radio could get through except what was in their country. The first time I visited Yugoslavia, I heard the people in Croatia speaking about the need for independence. I was highly skeptical. It's 1989. Yugoslavia consists of 6 republics, 5 nations, 4 languages, 3 major religions, 2 alphabets, 2 calendars, only 1 political party, the Communist Party. This was the reality, the red star of Yugoslavia. How on earth could Croatia get independence? But in 1990, the first multi-party elections were held in Croatia. On 25th of June 1991, Croatia declared independence, which came into effect 8th of October 1991. That declared its independence unilaterally, not recognized so by Yugoslavia. On the 15th of January 1992, Croatia was recognized as an independent country by the European Economic Community. The first country to recognize them was Germany. And this is Dubrovnik. My son went there a while ago and said, what a beautiful town. It looks beautiful now, but actually it was being shelled and it was during the war, it was in a bad state. The aggression by Yugoslavia has effectively ended in August 1995 with a decisive victory by Croatia. And since then, 5th of August has been observed as Victory in Homeland Thanksgiving Day. In Slovenia, A group of intellectuals articulated the case for Slovene independence in 1987. It's 2 years before the Berlin Wall came down. They firmly under communism. In the magazine Nova Rubija, the Committee for the Defense of Human Rights was formed. Demands for democratization and independence for Slovenia forced the communist government to enact a number of democratic reforms. In September 1989, constitutional amendments were passed to introduce parliamentary democracy to Slovenia. 7th of March 1990, the Slovene Assembly changed official name of the state to the Republic of Slovenia. In April 1990, first democratic elections in Slovenia took place. By the 23rd of December 1990, more than 88% of the electorate voted in the referendum for sovereign independent Slovenia. They declared their independence 25th of June 1991. The Yugoslav People's Army invaded on the 27th of June 1991, and this was the beginning of what was called the 9-day war, but sometimes the 10-day war, depends how you calculate it, and the result was the Brujuni Agreement and the withdrawal of the Yugoslav Army from Slovenia, December 1991. A new constitution was adopted, followed by laws on denationalization, privatization of all state enterprises by 1992. This was very fast. Slovenia really was amazingly fast. The members of the European Union recognized Slovenia as an independent state 15th of January 1992, Germany being the first country to recognize it. Now, there were six nations or republics in Yugoslavia: Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Serbia, Montenegro, and Macedonia. And this unwieldy empire had been held together only by repression and communist one-party states. When I first traveled to Bratislava in Czechoslovakia, talk of the Slovakians seceding from Czechoslovakia seemed unrealistic and impossible. They were behind the Iron Curtain. People's resistance against communism had been suppressed, crushed repeatedly. And you think of Hungary, all the attempts that they had to uprise against the communists. And they'd been street fighting before, now we're talking about 1956, and then Czechoslovakia 1968. Massive repression, and so people thought, you'll never be able to break out of the Warsaw Pact and away from communism, and let alone how could Slovakia break out of Czech and Slovakia. This is part of Prague Spring 1968, the Russian invasion. People tell them what they thought. My father-in-law, Reverend Bill Batten, was racing into Czechoslovakia from the west as people were pouring out by the hundreds of thousands. As he heard the Russians invading, he phoned Brother Andrew, said, meet him, Vinslav Square, and they were handing out Bibles in Russian to the Russians as they were invading Czechoslovakia. The Christians were adamant that Slovakia must become an independent country, which didn't seem possible at the time. And yet, instead, following the collapse of communist rule in Czechoslovakia in 1989 and the withdrawal of the Soviet Red Army, the Slovak Socialist Republic was renamed the Slovak Republic. And on the 17th of July 1992, Slovakia declared itself a sovereign state, meaning its laws took precedence over those of the federal government. Now, this is unilateral. There's no approval from the central government. But throughout the autumn of 1992, negotiations with the Czech federal government resulted in a vote, 31 December 1992, to dissolve Czechoslovakia. The Slovak Republic and the Czech Republic went their separate ways after 1st of January 1993. What they called the Velvet Divorce, because it was peaceful, no blood was shed, no violence, reason triumphed. As the overthrow of communist rule in Czechoslovakia had been called the Velvet Revolution, now the peaceful separation of Czech and Slovakia was called the Velvet Divorce. Now the Baltic states, originally conquered by the Vikings and later by the Soviet Union, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, these three Baltic states were occupied over the centuries, first by Sweden, then by Poland, and finally by Russia. The Republic of Latvia was established 18 November 1918, when it seceded from the Soviet Union. And the German army protected them, because the German army had just defeated the Russians, and they just had peace with the new Soviet Union at Treaty of Brest-Litovsk in 1918, March 1918. But unfortunately, the Treaty of Versailles reversed it, betrayed them, handed them back to Soviet Union in many cases. But they They managed in Latvia to stay independent of Soviet Union until 1940, when Stalin ordered the invasion of Latvia. But Latvia later was liberated by German forces during Operation Barbarossa in 1941. In 1944, the Soviet Union again invaded Latvia and forced it back into the Soviet Union. Starting in 1987, the Singing Revolution called for Baltic emancipation from communism and Soviet occupation. And this is what's called the Singing Revolution, because they had little protest options. And so they'd gather and they'd sing their patriotic national songs. And on the 4th of May 1990, the Declaration of the Restoration of Independence of the Republic of Latvia was issued. And on the 25th of August 1991, Latvia declared its independence. Now, the Soviet Union still existed, but Latvia said we're independent. Latvia has been declared the capital of culture in Europe, and its capital, Riga, is hosted to the Choir Olympics, which my daughter Daniela, as part of the Cape Town Youth Choir, participated in. 140 choirs from around the world gathered in Riga for this event, and by the way, the Stellenbosch Choir won the spiritual choral section. And magnificent, but they used singing as a weapon. Estonia was also occupied in the centuries by Polish, Swedish, and Russian forces, declared its independence 24th of February 1918. On the 6th of August 1940, Estonia was invaded, occupied by the Soviet Red Army under Stalin, and incorporated in the Soviet Union. Estonians continued to resist the Soviet occupation for years, even after the Second World War was over. The Forest Brothers resistance movement opposed Soviet policy of collectivization, based on equality concentration camps, and forced removals of Estonians to make way for Russian immigration. And they were fighting as late as 1954. 9 years after the Second World War, they were still fighting in the forests of Estonia against these people. In 1987, the Singing Revolution began, and by 1988, the Popular Front of Estonia began the standard bearer for Estonian independence. The Estonian National Independence Party was the first non-communist party in the Soviet Union. It demanded full restoration of independence. By the way, this is the chain. They had a chain of resistance spanning the three Baltic states, a continuous chain across them, where they were singing in resistance against the communist occupation. The candle became the symbol of resistance to communism. Started in Leipzig, Kremlin in Germany in 1982, the candle was symbolic of the fact that not all the darkness can put out the smallest light. My little candle is more powerful than all your darkness. And people would come with unlit candles, and then one candle would be lit, and then they'd spread, and then they'd go home and they'd put the candle in the windowsill of their home with the curtains open, all lights off, and so you had more and more houses just sort of symbolizing resistance to communism. Estonia never joined the USSR. Well, Kate could say that about the Union of South Africa, just forced on us, just like just forced to transform the priesthood. On the 16th of November 1988, the Estonian Supreme Soviet issued a sovereignty declaration asserting the primacy of Estonian laws over Soviet Union laws. On 23rd of August 1989, there actually had 2 million Estonians, Latvians, and Lithuanians participating in a mass demonstration forming the Baltic Way human chain across three republics demanding restoration of independence. And here you can see the cars, people lining up on the sides of the streets, and this is a phenomenal sign of unity and of resistance to communism. Peaceful. 1990, the Congress of Estonia was formed as a representative body of Estonian citizens. In March 1991, a referendum was held where 77% of the voters supported independence. A Moscow coup was attempted. Moscow tried a coup in Estonia, was exposed, and resisted. Estonia declared the restoration of independence 20th of August 1990, which is now observed as national holiday in Estonia. The last units of the Red Army finally left Estonia only in 1994, 4 years later, but the point is they acted as though they were independent before the Soviet Union recognized their independence. The last units of Red Army left in 1994. In 1992, though, Estonia enacted and launched economic reforms, privatization, market economy. In 2004, Estonia joined the European Union and NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization. My daughter tells me these are some of the loveliest people you can find. Really great people. So Estonian, part of the singing revolution. This is one of the choir limits. Lithuania seceded from the Soviet Union 16th February 1918 to form the Republic of Lithuania. In 1940, Lithuania was invaded, occupied by the Soviet Union, later liberated by the German army during Operation Barbarossa, later in 1944 invaded again by the Soviets. Well, on 11th of March 1990, a year before the formal dissolution of the Soviet Union, Lithuania became the first Baltic state to declare itself independent. On 11th of March 1990, a year before the formal dissolution of the Soviet Union, Lithuania declared itself, we are a free and independent country. So 11th of March 1990, the Supreme Council announced the restoration of Lithuania's independence. On the 28th of March 1990, the Soviet Union imposed an economic blockade in Lithuania, which lasted 74 days, complete economic blockade. But Lithuania was prepared, and people had stockpiled, and they stood firm. And when the Soviet Union attempted a coup in Lithuania, storming their palace, Lithuanians vigorously defended their council and inspired other republics to secede from the Union, but they did it peacefully. There was no violence. They recognized you can't win a war against the Red Army. We're a small little republic. They're a massive, huge, colossal empire. But so they used peaceful means of resistance. Shortly after 11th of February 1991, the Parliament of Iceland voted to confirm that Iceland recognized Lithuanian independence in 1922, still was in force. They'd never formally recognized the Soviet Union's occupation of Lithuania, so they didn't have to recognize it. They'd already recognized it in 1922, and that is still in force. Iceland stayed full diplomatic relationship being re-established as soon as possible. So 25th of October 1992, the citizens of Lithuania voted in a referendum to adopt the new constitution. Now you may wonder, what's the difference between these three republics and why don't they just form one republic? Well, they've all got different characteristics. And Estonia and Latvia is mostly Protestant, mostly Lutheran, whereas Lithuania is mostly Catholic, and while they've got mostly Viking ancestry, yet they've all got a very unique nationality, and while their languages are mutually understandable to some degree, like Spanish and Portuguese, they are distinct peoples and nations, and while they might be, they see themselves as sister states. They're related, but still, it's better to have three independent states than to have one big state. 31st of August 1993, the last units of the Russian army finally withdrew from Lithuanian territory. So they didn't get rid of the troops the moment they declared independence. It took time, but in time, international pressure, domestic stability of the people forced the Soviet Union out. Since 2004, Lithuania has been a member of NATO and of the European Union, which would have been unthinkable just a few decades ago. And here you can see some of the street marchers celebrating their anniversary, carrying a massive flag down the main road. Beautiful countries. And they were war zones in the 1940s. Tremendous to see how they've rebuilt. When the Soviet Union broke up, this was a very, very good thing. And all of these nations have finally been able, at least 15 of them, have formed their own countries out of what was once the Soviet Union. And so Russia now is not as big as the old Russian Empire, Soviet Empire was. And these are some of these magnificent countries. Since 1995, I've been involved in the campaign for South Sudan's independence. From 1995 to 2002, I've conducted 27 missions to Sudan, lasting an average of a month each, working even as far north as the Nuba Mountains of Sudan, flying far behind enemy lines, hours behind enemy lines, in areas where they had a shoot-on-sight policy, you fly, you die, no flights allowed into the Nuba Mountains, and out of the Christianity in the sea of Arab Islam. North of the 1040 window, north of the 10th degree latitude in the north, and walking in areas where they put price over here. The Sudan government on the Ministry of Foreign Affairs website says that Peter Hammond should expect to be shot on sight, he should expect to be bombed every time he comes to Sudan because his writings make him an enemy of the state. So, reason, because I've published the bombing of churches, human rights abuses, all the destruction that they're doing, crucifixion of pastors, chopping off the hands of people, all that, documenting things like this, churches being burned, helicopter gunship destructions. I've been in Sudan from one side to the other, and the scorched earth policies, the terror bombing campaigns, the destruction of all of South Sudan. This church has been bombed and destroyed three times. I've been on the fire in Sudan, numbers of occasions, including at churches where I've been preaching. This is the birthplace of Christianity in southern Sudan, the Cathedral of Loy, Fraser Cathedral. It's been bombed many times. In fact, they've had 10 aerial bombardments, and three times they've actually destroyed the church and we've had to leave it. This is the River Mountains. You can actually see a downed plane just behind there on the airstrip, and just between those folks there, and I'm handing over food to people in Lube Mountains on our exit flight. The things I've seen in the Lube Mountains of Sudan defy belief. But we've delivered over 500,000 Bibles and books in 24 languages throughout southern Sudan and Lube Mountains. And while working amongst them, it became clear to me they cannot be free until they have their own country, because there will always be a black Christian minority in a majority Arab Muslim country. Different alphabets, different calendars, different everything, unless they can read all the map and be an independent country. If only this had been done back in 1955, over 2 million lives could have been spared. This horrific war. We've taken textbooks, helped them. Well, I've been arguing and discussing with the people here from the very beginning, you have to have independence, or this war's just going to carry on forever. It's really been carrying on since 1955. The day the British left, the war erupted. The British left midnight on 31st of December 1955, and since then war. Well, we've been chartering planes, smuggling in Bibles, going behind the lines. The largest ship in the Bibles ever smuggled to an officially Islamic country in the 1040 window. This is a Second World War vintage DC-3. This ambulance came from Transvaal. We drove it up from Joburg. 9,700 Bibles, printed in Singapore, being delivered behind enemy lines. And here's the Sunday school books, hymn books. During this time, I've conducted 1,200 meetings in Sudan, behind the lines, worked with the chaplains, trained the medics, first medical corps, first chaplains corps. We equipped them, trained them, organized them. So I know Sudan. I know Sudan very well. Up in the mountains, I've walked from one side to the other, mountain marathons. And this church had been bombed 18 times in the 12-month period. 18 times. Also collected over 1,000 meetings, TV programs, radio programs, internationally to campaign for independence of Sudan during that time, 1995 to 2002. Put out the posters, wrote vast amounts of newsletters, posters, books, and I wrote the book, Faith and Defiance Sudan, first in 1996, then in 1998, and then the final one, 2010. Each one doubling the previous one, the last edition being three times the size of the original one. When I got death threats from the government for producing this book, I thought this is obviously successful, so we've got to produce more. Because that's the writing that made me an enemy of the state. They said that's the dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir, who just got overthrown last year, by the way. So 30 years, but at least he's overthrown. Over the years, I took in film crews who produced Sudan had an Holocaust, Terrorism and Persecution, 3 days in Sudan. This one was interesting because this was a South African television, SATV, war correspondent, photojournalist, and he told me, he was only in there for 3 days, but he told me at one point, you know, my assignment was to do a hatchet job on you. SATV told me, find Peter Hammond's man and destroy him. Do a hatchet job. And this man came, and he's a hard-bitten war correspondent, 22 years in films, worked in war zones, and on day two, he got bombed with us. He came under rocket and artillery bombardment between the church service while I was preaching Psalm 46. Amazing how bombing can change your perspective. Mm-hmm. And he ended up producing a very good, positive DVD on me. I've got the DVD here, it's going to be part of your library. So, which has got all three. That's positive. I don't know, but he identifies himself in the film. I've just forgotten this moment. the name, I mean, I only met him on that trip, but he produced a very good film. Well, I brought in filmmakers like Pat Matriciano, of Jeremiah Films, who produced Savannah Hidden Holocaust, Terrorism and Persecution, and helped Samaritan's Purse of Franklin Graham to establish their hospital there and helped them with their first films on Savannah 2. Initially, even the leaders of the Sydney's People's Liberation Army, the SPLA, John Varang and Sylvia Kerr, were very skeptical that the map could ever be redrawn. They said the African Union has resisted any changes to borders delineated in the Berlin Conference of 1884 to 1885. And the Berlin Conference of 1884 to 1885 drew up the map often using a ruler, taking a latitude or a longitude or a river, like people don't live on two sides of the same river. And just insane things were decided, but yet the African Union will not countenance changing the map. I strenuously argued with Commander Sylvia Kerr and Colonel John Garang. That's John Garang in the middle, second from the left, and Sylvia Kerr, second from the right. So John Garang was the head of the SPLA and Sylvia Kerr was the second in command at the time. I argued with them only independence for South Sudan to secure the future and the independence. And they were just fighting for autonomy for the South. I said, but then the war will carry on forever. This is a map I drew up myself, recognizing South Sudan, I called it New Sudan, at that stage, separate from Northern Sudan. Sudan was the largest country in Africa before secession in 2011. And so, long before the leaders of the SPLA were aiming for full independence, I was aiming for full independence. Anything else would mean the continuation of oppression by the Arab North, as they'd always be a minority in their own country. Although blacks are majority in South Sudan, they're minority in the whole country of Sudan. Missionaries had pleaded with Great Britain back in 1955 not to include black Christians and animists of the South into an Arab-ruled Sudan, culturally, linguistically, every way, too divergent. This is just a recipe for conflict. Suggestions were made to incorporate Equatoria into Kenya or Uganda, but to no avail. From the very first day of independence, 1 January 1956, the Arab North sought to Arabize and Islamize the South. Brutal oppression, great devastation, loss of life. Forced Arabic to be the official language, where English had been the unifying language. So forced Fridays of their rest instead of Sunday. All sorts of things on with this Islamization, Arabization. Children beaten for speaking the tribal language, had to speak Arabic. Forced to stand in the playground holding a rock in each hand, whipped if they lowered their hands, and had to recite in Arabic and so on. I showed from Sudan's history and from the teachings of Islam why the only way to be free of Sharia law and Arab oppression was to fight for full independence and sovereignty of South Sudan and Nuba Mountains. Although they were highly skeptical that it was at all possible, today South Sudan is an independent country, internationally recognized, and Sylvia Kerr, standing next to me here in the middle, is today the president of South Sudan since 9 July 2011. As recently as 2001, he was arguing that it's not possible. The theme of South Sudan independence was let my people go. All for separation. And this was the referendum in 2005 for whether they will go for independence. And they, when they decided we will go for independence in 2005, then they started preparing, and it finally was in 2011. The polling stations, New Dawn, Juba, celebration, independence, new flag, and here's many of the veterans who've lost limbs in the war, and new uniforms. I must say, it must be rough being forced to wear white gloves out there in Equatoria. It's hot there. I believe it can get quite hot here in summer. Normal temperatures in the 40s over there. Sylvia Kerr, you might wonder where this hat comes from. This is a Texan hat. George Bush gave it to him when he visited America, and he wears it like a crown, and now this is part of the whole style there. A lot of people in South Sudan want a cowboy hat, Texas hat like this. And holding up the new constitution, and I don't know if you can see in the background, there's Franklin Graham, the Samaritan's Purse. I recruited Franklin Graham to go into Sudan really in 1996. You must come to Sudan, set up the hospital there. That was quite a story, because, in fact, right from the beginning, when I started going to stand, I asked people, what do you need? And the first thing, we need Bibles. We need Bible teachers. We need schools. Next thing they asked me, they said, we need a hospital. We don't have a hospital for 5 million people in Equatoria. So, well, man's got those limitations. I'm not medical. My mother was a nurse, but all I know is first aid. Okay, so we brought in paramedic equipment. I trained medics in 4Bs, breathing, bleeding, breakages, and burns. Don't know much more than that. I was in the fire brigade, nothing much more. So after a two-day seminar, I think I'd exhausted my medical knowledge, even with the translators taking time between. We gave them good paramedic packs, but then I brought them a nurse to train them further. And then I was writing to Franklin Graham, Samaritan's Purse, because I'd seen them in Rwanda. When everyone fled Rwanda, Médecins Sans Frontières had fled, Doctors Without Borders, Red Cross had fled. There was no medical work in the whole of Rwanda during the war there, but Samaritan's Purse was there. I was with them, and these people put on their overalls, put on big Wellington boots, and waded into the hospital in Kigali to remove 9,000 corpses, to remove the congealed blood, break up the congealed blood in the gutters and so on, to get the drainage system working that they could reopen the hospital. I mean, what disgusting work. We're chasing rats at night. I was sleeping in the Samaritan's Purse mission house, and we'd be batting away rats with our mag lights and machetes. There's just rats everywhere, rats. One poor American woman who was terrified of rats, she chose the top bunk, forgetting the fact that rats tend to be in the roof and it came down from the roof. So she woke up with screams all running around there, what's happening. She was in the top bunk and this rat jumped on top and started chewing on it, which I don't think is everybody's idea of a good time. So this was the reality. So I thought Samaritan's Purse is a group. They're a real mission, medical mission, who will go into bad places. So I wrote to Franklin Graham in North Carolina to ask if I could communicate with him and would they be interested in going to Sudan. Secretary wrote back a polite letter, sorry, too busy, overcommitted, not possible. Okay. Next thing was, I heard Franklin Graham's come to Cape Town. 1996, Newlands, cricket grounds. My dad used to be the Western Province Cricket Union manager running the whole show there, had his office there, and I thought, this is going to be excellent. Right, so I wrote immediately, could have a meeting when he comes to Cape Town. Same secretary, sorry, overcommitted, too busy, no opportunity. Now I'm thinking, there's got to be a way. I'm sitting at my desk in this barn that used to be our office, wondering how are we going to get to Franklin Graham, this has got to be possible. And suddenly, along comes a beautiful card from the post office, gilt embossed from the mayor's office. The mayor of Cape Town invited me to a prayer breakfast where Franklin Graham will be the guest speaker. Well, how's that for timing? So I made sure I was there early, parked my motorbike as close to the door as I could, walked in with my motorbike helmet over my arm, and Franklin Graham, the mayor, was standing there by the door. I might have been the first person there as far as I can see. I said, Franklin Graham, so good to meet you. I believe you're also a motorbiker. He beamed. Yes, he's got a Harley Davidson. And I said, I believe you've also been training chaplains for the Contras in McGregor. Yes, I have, he said. So I've been training chaplains for Renama and UNITA, Freedom Fighters in Mozambique and Angola, and Esperance in Sudan. Mr. Graham, I've got one question for you. Why is Samaritan's Purse not in Sudan? He said, we have been in Sudan. I said, yes, several years ago in Upper Nile, but you were working with Riek Machar's crowd. They surrogates for the Arabs. I didn't know that, he said. I knew he had a bad experience. And that's why he pulled out of Sudan. We've been in a bad area trusting bad people. I said, I know just the place for you, the first hospital ever established in South Sudan by Dr. Kenneth Fraser. And this hospital is in good shape still, can be renovated, and there's not a hospital for 5 million people. But by now other people are arriving, he says, I'll talk to you later. Had to go through. He brought Ken Isaacs's operations man a little bit late during the breakfast. I said, Ken Isaacs, Peter Hammond, operations man, tell him what you told me. So when I start talking, this man is sitting there with his arms folded, knees crossed, very close. In a few minutes, he's leaning forward and he's looking at my pictures and maps and 2 days later, I get a phone call saying, Franklin's given the green light. We need you to take us into stand 2 days from now. So I need a bit of warning. I said, 2 days from now? I've got commitments. He says, Peter, you've got a green light. Go to the intersection. Okay, cancelled everything on my plates. 2 days later, I was leading this team into Sudan. And within 3 weeks, they were back renovating the hospital. Extraordinary. But they were there for 10 years. In that time, they had hundreds of thousands of consultations and tens of thousands of operations. They saved on a lot of lives. In fact, I saw one statistic that they think that Samaritan's Purse medical work could have saved 300,000 lives in Sudan during that 10 years. And a lot of good work. Celebration Day of Independence. I mean, just look at this. This man raising what's left of his arms in praise to God for the freedom of South Sudan. From today, our identity is Southern and African, not Arabic and Islamic. We are not worse Arabs, we're better African. Independence, South Sudan. Anniversaries of independence, and this is in Juba. New flag, new map, redrew the map. They've got their own seal, justice, liberty, and prosperity, their own currency, Sudanese pounds. Free at last is the sign that you see coming in there. Now, sadly, there's complications, and the worst of it is they discovered oil in South Sudan at about this time. Very, 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 very sad. This oil seems to be a recipe for war. So sadly, there's been ongoing conflict, but South Sudan has more freedom and a higher life expectancy now, much higher than did before, because a huge amount of medicals come in, a huge amount of water wells and so on. So today we continue to campaign for freedom and independence for the Nuba Mountains and Island of Christianity and Sea of Islam. Nuba Mountains is up here in South Kordofan, basically there. So it's not part of independent South Sudan, but culturally, linguistically, religiously, they would like to be. There's also Blue Nile. We've done some work there as well. But in the last few years, my son-in-law, Hunter, and other of our missionaries have been going into Nuba Mountains at way behind the lines. And they're still at war there, officially. Although there is a ceasefire at this moment, thankfully. And we've been able to take a vast amount of Bibles and books in Arabic, English, and in other open moral languages. Up there, there's about 50 different indigenous languages in Nuba Mountains. And these people, of course, want to be free and independent, either as part of South Sudan or as the Nuba Mountains as their own country. So starting in Cape Town, we drive all the way up 8,000 kilometers one way, by the way. The courageous Nuban Christians continue to resist the Arabization, Islamization policies of the Khartoum government in South Sudan. Redrawing the map is absolutely essential for peace, to recognize ethno-linguistic demographic realities and to avoid further loss of life in future conflicts. It's good for both sides. We must not continue to follow in the footsteps of failure. Centralization in a unitary state is as doomed to failure as the Tower of Babel, which, by the way, the European Union is built like. This is the European Union in Salzburg, and they built it like Bruegel's Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel, centralization. That's Bruegel's famous painting of Tower of Babel. Here's the EU's poster, Europe, many times one voice. And this is what the Parliament in Strasbourg looks like. Now, I mean, is that blatant or is that blatant? This is the kind of, you know, fist of rebellion towards God. We don't want decentralization, we want centralization. They're going to reverse paper. That's basically what the EU says. We need to emulate examples of excellence, such as this decentralized model of Switzerland. You know, when a country's got a plus in their flag, that's very positive. Switzerland is one of the freest, most prosperous countries in the world, with one of the highest standards of living in the world. And they are the founders of the referendum. And they are as decentralized as... I mean, one of the things, just to show you why you've got to love the Swiss. Some time ago, the Swiss government wanted to disband the homing pigeon regiment. Defunct, it's out of date. Why do you need a homing pigeon regiment? The people got enough signatures, had a referendum, beat the government. Homing pigeon regiment stays. Why? governments can interfere with almost any form of communication, but they can't interfere with home churches. You've got to love with people who don't trust the government like that. Yeah. That's just really attractive. And the free enterprise model of Singapore, the Berlin Conference, also known as the Congo Conference or the West Africa Conference, sought to avoid conflict by regularizing European protectorates and colonies in Africa to effectively eradicate the slave trade and to avoid conflict between European powers. The European powers gathered at this conference were also seeking to prevent rising American, Russian, and Japanese encroachments on Africa. But there wasn't one single African representative at the Berlin Conference. And the only American representative was Henry Morgan Stanley. And they didn't listen to his advice either. But due to lack of information, a very incomplete understanding of the realities of Africa, often the borders were drawn along lines of longitude or latitude or along the river, and they challenged the nations living on both sides of those arbitrary border markings. Doubtless they didn't realize at that time. Now, you may not be able to fully blame the Berlin Conference, but the AU, who doesn't want to change the boundaries from the Berlin Conference, they should be blamed. In my missionary work, it's become clear the map needs to be redrawn. Half the Shangaan people live in Mozambique and half live in South Africa. Half speak English and half speak Portuguese. Half the Evander people live in Angola, where they speak Portuguese, and drive on the right-hand side of the road, and half live in Southwest Africa and will be learning Afrikaans English driving on the left-hand side of the road. Why? They're in two different time zones, despite being north and south of each other. The Chichewa people are divided between Malawi, Zambia, and Mozambique, and you could continue with this throughout Africa. The Berlin Conference boundaries of Africa don't make sense. The greatest conflicts in Africa, including the Biafran Civil War of 1967 to 1970, the Congo Wars, the long conflict in Sudan, would have been averted if they'd drawn a map along ethno-linguistic lines and recognized demographic realities, not forced some people to be minorities in their own country, oppressed by other tribes, other cultures, other religions. It's just not fair. And so, to look at Africa from a demographic, linguistic, religious, cultural perspective, let's recognize communities to be real communities, not where most people are oppressed by others. It's just not right, and it's just asking for trouble. In Nigeria, for example, which honestly is one mega empire, 480 tribes and language groups, the Hausa and Fulani are Muslim, the Yoruba and Igbo are Christian. And, you know, you might think they could make three countries out of that, or two or something, but no, and so you've got ongoing conflict. Terrible conflict in Nigeria. The Biafran Civil War was a horrific one. Millions of people killed. And so, just looking at some of the major breakdowns of racial groupings in Africa, you can get the impression. Now, take the coin in the sand. There's evidence in the rock cave paintings of the Khoisan civilization going all the way up to Kenya, East Africa. But they don't live anywhere except in the Cape, Botswana, and in Namibia. Why? Because the Bantu tribes moving down exterminated them. The only places where the Khoisan sand survived is where Europeans came and were able to protect them. In every one of the frontier wars between the settlers in the Cape and the causes of Transkei, the Khoisan sand were on the Dutch or British or white side because they recognized the threat to their very survival and existence was impossible. It was just a threat. And so, again, you can see these alliances, realistic alliances that come about. And so, understanding linguistic family groups helps us. Again, you can see here, we've got the Khoi in the Sand area, which is uniquely now on the southwest of Africa. If you're going down to actual ethno-linguistic groupings, this is what the map might look more realistically. And why not? Why not have confederations of microstates where communities are real communities where they, you know, good fences make good neighbors and you can get on well with your neighbors when you know that they're not a threat to your argument? It's inexcusable that since independence, the Organization of African Unity, now the AU, has steadfastly refused to allow maps to be reborn. And so the AU has become a threat to emerging African states, a threat to independence movements, Because they want Africa to be like this. These boundaries are sacrosanct and we're not allowed to change these boundaries. Well, they did allow Eritrea to get the independence in our South Sudan. So the genie's out the bottle. We have started to redraw the map, so maybe we can go further forward. The apparent exception of Eritrea, though, was a separate entity and only forced to be part of Abyssinia at the end of the Second World War, when the British took over the Italian-controlled Abyssinia and forced Eritrea and forced it to be part of Haile Selassie's Ethiopian Empire. And this led to a long-standing civil war until Eritrea's independence was re-established in 1991. Again, millions died unnecessarily for this experiment of forcing Eritrea to be under Abyssinia, what then was called Ethiopia. So the redrawing of the maps and recognition of independence of South Sudan was a monumentally important precedent. For the first time, post-independence Africa redrew the map, different from how the Berlin Conference of 1884 did it. That makes it super significant. The Nuba of South Kordofan at this moment fighting for independence from Sudan, and the Kurds of Turkey and of Iraq and Iran are seeking their own country of Kurdistan. Kurdistan should be its own country. The Kurds, by the way, in the Bible they're the Medes. The Darius the Mede, who put it on the line stem, is a Mede. The Medes, or the Kurds, are a phenomenal country, but Winston Churchill, who was Secretary of Colonies at that time, drew the map of the Middle East after the British and French were carving up the Ottoman Empire, and gave Kuwait the oil-rich state, its own entity. Why? Why is it not part of Iraq, what used to be Babylon? And how did the Kurds get divided between Iran and Babylon, or Iraq and Turkey? Why couldn't they be their own country? When the Kurds protested, Winston Churchill ordered stop of camels to drop mustard gas on them. Disgraceful. Shameful. The Kurds have been badly treated by, I'm sorry to say, all three. Turkey, Iran, and Iraq have all mistreated the Kurds horribly. And most recently, the Americans took their allies, let them help them when they were taking over Iraq. Just obviously, the Kurds were not happy with Saddam Hussein. They'd gotten bombed also with mustard gas and so on. So they weren't very happy with them either. But then America just abandons them, and ISIS comes in and starts to murder them by the thousands. So the Kurds really have got a good case to be an independent country, just one of many examples. This is what Kurdistan should be like. But Turkey does everything they can to crush the Kurds. And the Kurds are a major people. This is how one map looks at what Kurdistan could be like. And just like Turkmenistan or Kyrgyzstan or Tajikistan, why are they not their own independent country? They deserve to be. 42 million. They should be their own country. This is not insignificant. Wow. Beyond horrific. Sadly, a lot by the Turks, a lot by the Saddam Hussein's Iraq, but ISIS has done a hideous amount just recently. Catalonia, northern part of Spain, they've been campaigning for independence, and as you can see, they've been very successful in mobilizing the people, although they're not yet recognized by Spain, who doesn't want this to happen. But I think Catalonia is right there in the north of Spain. Now, this is a map of Europe where you can see the lines where the national boundaries are, but this recognizes demographics, so ethno-linguistic people groups distinct from a national boundary. So there's room for some readjustments of boundaries. That's just Europe. But there's an ethno-linguistic map, genetic map, showing the different racial groupings in Europe in particular. And again, there's more looking into it, particularly in Europe. And again, this is looking where the Germanic DNA is most prevalent. And again, this is not all of Germanic parts of Europe. One does need to remember that the Vikings, the Germans, and the ones who invaded and took over England, 1066, are Germanic types, and so you can see different ways of looking there. And here we're looking at different regions which could easily ask for independence. Scotland had a chance to vote for independence and chose not to. They lost it. I don't know what poor William Wallace would have thought of that. They actually had a referendum and they lost it. But the thing to notice here is we've passed the day where countries go to war over secession. Canada, the French-speaking parts of Canada wanted independence, they had a secession vote, and the majority voted against. But if they wanted to go, Canada would have let French Toronto and so on go. Scotland was given a chance, and Britain wouldn't have gone to war with Scotland if Scotland had chosen independence. It would have happened. It would have been a divorce, not a war. So we've gotten to the stage where you see groups seceding without a war, like Czech and Slovakia. So obviously we've reached a stage where it's no longer considered acceptable to do what Abraham Lincoln did, just wage a ruinous war to preserve the Union. Unions are not worth preserving by war. So if you think about it in the sense of divorce, what would you think in a case where there's an abusive marriage, where one partner, let's say the husband, beats and abuses and is emotionally abusive and physically abusive to his wife, and she runs away to her parents or whatever, wants to get divorced from? What do you think if he came and killed her parents and burned down her parents' house and killed her dog and beat her up and forced her to come back in there? Would you say, he preserved the Union? Well, they built statues to Abraham Lincoln for preserving the Union, and Lenin as well for preserving the Soviet Union when Ukraine saw a terrible breakaway. But this is no longer considered acceptable. They might have glamorized these people who were abusive before, but I don't think anybody today generally thinks it's acceptable to go to war because some people want to be free and independent, especially in an abusive relationship. So there was a time when civil wars took place over secessions. I don't think that is socially acceptable or normative right now. Witness the fact that we've seen Brexit, we've seen Scotland actually given an independence vote, we've seen Toronto being given an opportunity for Quebec to secede. So these are potential independent states in Europe right now. Flanders and Wallonia, I think, are seceding from Belgium. Brittany from France, Galicia in the Basque Country, Catalonia wanting to break away from Spain. You can see there's Kurdistan is very much on the map for that. Kosovo, of course, has been a long time battle there and so on. So there's definitely, these are very, very potential independent states coming out or emerging states in Europe. And again, this is looking at a potential map of Europe of if the different nation states are given their independence, what the map could begin to look like. And this is feasible because no longer, since the Yugoslav War, are countries in Europe thinking about fighting to prevent a secession. So, who knows? The maps of Europe could change in the future. It's just speculative. But looking at Hong Kong, you know, was a phenomenally successful economy. And you know, the only reason why Red China's economy has grown so much is because they absorbed Hong Kong. Now, Hong Kong's economy is now part of Red China's economy. Before 1997, Hong Kong had a bigger economy than Red China. Now, what does Hong Kong have? No natural resources, but they had a free, tax haven, place of free enterprise. And Hong Kong developed a bigger economy than the whole of Red China. And today, what are the people in Hong Kong campaigning with? This is the flag. They're putting up the old British colonial flag. I would have thought they could come up with a better one, but they love the old British colonial flag because to them it represents a time of freedom that they couldn't get under Red China. And so this, I think, short-circuits the brains of a lot of politically correct liberals that in Hong Kong, the people are now flying the old Union Jack and the old colonial flag of Hong Kong because they want Chinese colonists out. They want freedom for Hong Kong, and I think we can think that for the Cape too. So, I've got some videos here, I've got my notes here for the case for Cape independence, and obviously you're here putting feet to this whole vision. You're not asking for independence, you take it, and we are very grateful. So, I've got notes on this morning's sermon, I've got notes on this lecture I've just given, and these are free for you to take and help yourself to the notes, and there's a notebook I put back if you want to be on my email list. So, question time. Any questions, comments, complaints, or criticisms?
Yes.
Well, actually,
but
that's not true. That's the pretext. Every warning is a pretext. And so, you know, they may say that things are, this is for freedom, this is for freeing the slaves or whatever, but, for example, the fact that Abraham Lincoln was not interested in the freeing of the slaves is proven by many different points. First of all, Abraham Lincoln said in public and in writing, if allowing slavery would preserve the Union, I'd allow slavery. If abolishing slavery would preserve the Union, I'd abolish slavery. Whatever will preserve the Union. And he was willing to offer the Confederates that they could be in perpetuity having slavery if they would stay in the Union. Slavery wasn't an issue. And when he gave us an Emancipation Proclamation in 1563, he expressly only gave it in those territories controlled by the Confederates, which meant in territory he didn't control. He didn't free any slaves in northern controlled areas. His great general, Ulysses Grant, who then became American president, owned thousands of slaves, something like 3,000 slaves. There was, in fact, a lot of northerners owned slaves. Nobody was ever enslaved under the Confederate flag. The ships that brought slaves to America, through the American Stars and Stripes, the slave traders were in Boston, in the northern parts of American view. The people who employed the slaves were mostly in the south, cotton fields and so on. But they actually treated their slaves a lot better than the northern ones, who were the industrialists. So it's not as clear-cut as they would like to make. For example, the head of the southern armies, the Confederate armies in the United States of America, was General Robert E. Lee, who had freed all his slaves and who was against slavery, and his number two was Stonewall Jackson, General Thomas Jackson, was against slavery. And Thomas Jackson and Robert E. Lee pleaded with the Virginian legislature, abolish slavery, set all the slaves free, then declare independence. Take away the excuse the Northerners are using. And sadly, the southern states dithered on this, but they all agreed it had to go. They just weren't sure how to get it to the tiger, kind of thing. And they'd inherited this mess, and they were trying to phase it out, but they should have been decisive. Free the slaves, then declare independence. That would have been the right way. And then Britain might have been able to help itself. But Britain couldn't help a country that still practiced slavery. This was Britain's strongest foreign policy goal of the 19th century. Abolition of slave trade, fight the slave trade, set the slaves free. And Britain would like to have supported the Confederates because, first of all, they'd like to get back to the, get the Union back, who had invaded Canada, started the 1812 war and all of that. That war ended in the favor of the U.S., Battle of New Orleans, all that stuff. So the point of saying that slavery was the point of it isn't possible because only 8% of the Confederate soldiers owned slaves. So what were the other Confederate soldiers fighting for?
Money.
I don't even know if the Confederate soldiers were paid. A lot of them didn't even have boots.
They were,
and do you know, there were more blacks in the Confederate Army than there were in the Northern Army. And, you know, if you've read the book or watched the film Gone with the Wind, you can see how a lot of the Southern blacks were, go get them Yankees, and they were enthusiastic going out to dig the trenches and to fight against the Yankees, and these damn Yankees coming and looting our farms and stuff. So it wasn't as clear-cut as they like to make out. But remember, propaganda and war. You always define your side in the best light and the other side in the worst light. So, for example, if you get take Rhodesia. What did Mugabe and Zanu said? We're fighting for the freedom of black people in Rhodesia. But 85% of the Rhodesian army were black volunteers. Whites were conscripted, but blacks were volunteers. Who were the terrorists killing? Mostly black people, murdering them terribly, 30,000 in fact. And who suffered once Mugabe managed to liberate people? The blacks and Barbarians, particularly the Matabele. But the picture is black versus white. But the ranch was black and white together against red. So, but bear in mind, America, because the Union won, their version of history has tended to predominate, and Hollywood's pushed it, but it doesn't actually weigh up on the scale of things. So, for example, I go to a lot of home education festivals in the United States, and the homeschoolers are solidly pro-Confederate. Even the Yankees. I mean, I can go to Maine, Connecticut, New Hampshire, Nebraska, and when they've got plays or any historic festivals, or they have their ballrooms, they're all dressed as Confederates and Southerners, even Yankees. But none of them want to wear the blue, because as homeschoolers, they've looked at the history, they study it, and even the Yankees, they say, we're on the wrong side. This is bad. And America's gotten worse since 1865. America was a free country. And since then, it's gotten more and more intrusive, top-down, where central government is interfering with everyone, right down to the farmer. So it's not as clear-cut as they would like to make out. Not at all. Even though the South made a terrible, terrible, terrible mistake in not abolishing slavery before declaring independence. I mean, that was inexcusably foolish. Because it was way past its sell-by date. Britain had set the slaves free in 1833. The Americans were behind in it. But many of the Southerners say, but we're treating them really well, and so on and so forth. But that wasn't the issue. They weren't treating the slaves as badly as the Northerners, that's true. But sadly, they had slaves, and that was indefensible, and they need to get rid of it. Imagine if they'd been that decisive. So, again, same thing with South Africa. Many people see it as the whole issue is apartheid. Well, as one of the soldiers on the border, I know I was not fighting for apartheid. I was part of an English liberal family from Rhodesia where we had no apartheid, and I was openly, verbally critical of apartheid in writing and so on, but we were on the board to fight communism and terrorism. Now, how much better South Africa could have abolished apartheid, scrapped the name and everything else, and decentralized and so on, and beforehand, taken the ammo out of the hands of the enemy. But sadly, they let the enemy have a propaganda field day because of something that was way past its sell-by date and which was not morally justifiable. Sadly, politicians don't see the light until they feel the heat. Sorry for the long answer. Any other questions, comments? Yes.
I'd say that personally, I believe that most wars and situations were not based on the separation and religion and all the other bullshit excuses that people tend to come up with. It's always been a fight over resources. The requirement of more resources by the limited few, and people do whatever they can to achieve that. Gain more resources. You are there in Namibia back in the day, 1867, back then, you were fighting for terrorism and Soviet domination. You didn't protect the diamond fields for our friends, the Ottomans.
Well, that wasn't my motivation, but you're saying that's what was behind their minds. I don't think any of us would have been happy to be there to fight for the Oppenheimers, but
we didn't.
Yeah.
No.
Now, it's interesting you say that. You know, in the First World War, they mobilized South Africa, you've got to go attack German Southwest Africa because they've got this major shortwave radio station at Lüderitz, which is endangering the entire Royal Navy, apparently. If anyone believes that. So, South Africa invaded. And then we brought in so on. When they came back from taking Southwest Africa, where I think we outnumbered the defenders like 20 to 1, they were given freedom of the city in Kimberley, and Oppenheimer, well, Oppenheimer was mayor there, thanked them in a public speech in Kimberley, 1915. Now, over 85% of all the world's diamonds fall under the Beers, and we control all the diamonds now because of Namibia's own. And the soldiers came back for, what about, we thought this was about shortwave radio station in Lüderitz. That's what they told us, and we didn't know we were going in to do this for the Beers. So, during the Anglo-Boer War, in 1901, Christmas 1901, every British Canadian New Zealand, Australia, and so on, soldiers in South Africa, so like 480,000, received that hamper, a very generous hamper, from the Rothschilds. It had Christmas pudding, cigarettes, cigars, pipe tobacco, sweets, all sorts of goodies, playing cards, with a card, and the picture of it is in the Genocide of the Boers book by Stephen Richard Goodson, who used to be a director of Southern Reserve Bank. And there's Christmas wishes from the Rothschilds, who were all three Jews, but anyway, thanking the British soldiers for what they were doing, and personally signed by the three top Rothschilds. Now, imagine when you're on the border that your donkey, tunny, Southern Cross pack came with a letter from Harry Oppenheimer, thank you so much, or Ernst Oppenheimer, thank you for what you're doing for the Beers. We would bring, huh? We're not happy for you. But during the Anglo-Boer War, the Rothschilds basically acknowledged all the new here to enable us to get control of the diamonds and the gold in the Transvaal priesthood. And it's like, this is, if the average American soldier was told, you're in Iraq and apple sand for the oil, many of them would have not volunteered if they knew that's why they've got to go there. So, obviously in propaganda there's another purpose before. You know, you're doing this for
weapons of mass destruction.
Exactly.
They
haven't come yet.
I have to say, what is it about Palestine when they try and capture them? But when I understand that they went into, was it a place called the Middle East called the Drugs of
Afghanistan?
Afghanistan, the West needed to get that back.
Yeah.
It was a major cash cow. So they went and got it back, and they got their cash cow back. But what is keeping Palestine alive? What are the resources in the Palestinian?
Okay, well, bluntly, I asked this question once. Any of you know who Stephen Mitford Goodson is? So Stephen Mitford Goodson was director of the Southern Reserve Bank for about 10 years. He's written a book, Inside the Southern Reserve Bank. He is a whistleblower on the corruption of the Southern Reserve Bank. And he also wrote A History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind. Then he wrote, Stephen Mitford Goodson. We had him speaking at a Reformation Society a few times, and he also wrote a book on Jan Smuts, because Jan Smuts wanted to put the Southern Reserve Bank in its position to control our debt in this country and so on. Then he wrote a book on Hendrik Witt, who was trying to dismantle the Reserve Bank and got himself killed while trying to do so. And then he wrote a book on the Genocide of Boers, on the Rothschilds basically employing the entire British and Imperial forces to crush the Transvaal and the Free State for control of the gold and diamonds. So you can see where he's coming from. Well, I asked Stephen Mitford Goodson this. Actually, I didn't ask this. Tim Miller asked Tim Miller, Jack Miller's father. Tim Miller said, why did they want to start Palestine? I mean, it was taking Palestine turned to State of Israel. And Stephen Goodson's answer was, the Rothschilds wanted a safe house, a nation where anyone, you know, like Jeffrey Epstein and so on, can go and flee to be free from paedophilia charges or whatever it is. They needed a nation where they could be outside of anyone else's law. In fact, there's a huge amount of people who've escaped from American justice alone, wanted for paedophilia charges and so on, who moved to the state of Israel. So that's interesting. But how does Palestine survive? Hollywood? Holocaust? Billions and billions and billions of euros from Germany and billions of dollars from America here. Do you know that of all the foreign aid in all of history, which is, foreign aid wasn't a thing before the 20th century. Yeah, nations had to build themselves up. Foreign aid, if you took all the foreign aid of the 20th century, the State of Israel has received more than half of it. The State of Israel doesn't just receive more foreign aid than every country in the world combined, but they've received more than every country combined in all of history. And they've only been around since about 1948. So the State of Israel, that is not economically viable without the billions of dollars they get from the United States American taxpayer, thank you, and from the German taxpayer, which I don't thank them for. So it's basically a parasitic state that's totally leeches off other countries and built manipulation and control of media and Hollywood. And they're the eternal victim, and it doesn't matter what they do to the Palestinians, it's all the Palestinians' fault, because they shouldn't be there in the first place. So that was basically the answer of Stephen McPherson to why on earth is America involved in all these wars. You know, some people say America's best ally in the Middle East is Israel. But then others say that America didn't have any enemies in the Middle East until Israel started. And so Israel sucked the United States into so many wars in the Middle East, almost entirely for Israel's benefit. Why is America involved in Syria? Syria is a very efficient, well-run country, or was, before it started during Hamid. It was a secular state in the Middle East where everyone was free, and 6% of the population Christians, enjoying more religious freedom than anywhere else in the Middle East. And the next thing, Syria gets targeted, and the US is helping to finance and start ISIS and supporting Al-Qaeda and Nusra Front affiliates, the very people who they blame for the 2001 bombings which justified the war against terror, and now they're actually funding the very terrorists that targeted America, according to the narrative, if we believe it. They have an enemy. There is no doubt they have an enemy.
So how does this affect us, this conversation, how does this affect us, how do we go forward? I mean, what do we have to do with our secession and show on the road?
Right, so of course, if anybody's putting their faith in the United Nations or the United States or the South African government or the Organization of Community, of course that's a totally false hope. In fact, they'll be ice skating in hell before you'll get justice from those characters. So obviously the first thing is don't waste your time, energy, or get yourself disillusioned expecting justice from the globalists. The globalists are against us. We know this. However, not even going their way, but they have a lot of things which they try to get done which have just failed. And just look at the fact that when they were moving unity, and then suddenly you get Brexit, and you get all these countries breaking away in Eastern Europe, and they didn't see, or Yugoslavia breaking up, and they don't want that. They're trying to get centralization, but the tide of history has moved to decentralization. There's a rise of nationalism, and right now, in France, Marine Le Pen's National Front Party is so close to getting a majority. And Geert Wilders' party, the Freedom Party in Netherlands, is very likely to be a future government. In Austria, the National Freedom Party has also won the elections there. And there's a tide of nationalism. A lot of people are sick to death of globalism and the UN and the EU and all the rest of it. And as for the AU, they've both been embarrassed about South Sudan's independence and Eritrea and things like this. But I think the genie's out of the bottle. I think decentralization is the way of the future, and you can see it with Catalonia, you can see it with others. There's a lot of movements for freedom. And I don't think you need to ask anyone for permission. I think one's just got to take it. Because central government cannot keep the lights on. Central government can't keep the water flowing. Central government can't pay the bills. Central government's so darn inefficient, illogical. I mean, you can just see it with, you've all got to wear masks, and which isn't healthy. You've got to jog with masks. You can arrest somebody for jogging around an empty field. How's this making this? Arrest surfers? They can't arrest state capture. So, if you take a man like R.W. Johnson, British economist, who wrote the book, How Long Will South Africa Survive? He wrote back in 1980s, I think 1987, How Long Will South Africa Survive Then? He wrote another book recently, 2015, I think, How Long Will South Africa Survive? And he predicts South Africa's going to break up. It can't continue to pay the bills. The economy is falling. Government's failing on every level. As he said, the ANC doesn't have enough intelligence to run a small village, let alone a complicated first world country. And he believed that Western Cape's going to secede first, followed by King Mazuland and others. Yes, so R.W. Johnson's moved his whole family to Table Butte. So that's an interesting thing that he believes in the Western Cape enough to move here. I think economically, well, economics has always been the weak point of socialists and communists and globalists. They've got these grand plans, but they never work. And so, again, basic biblical economics. Don't get into debt and be self-sufficient, be a good neighbor, these sort of things. Don't depend on others. And so this business of looking to daddy state and the government to bail us out, obviously that's failed. So the people who can organize their own food and water and get themselves organized, become, get off the grid, not depend on Eskom for your power failures. You can have your own power failures. Why have their power failures and expensive power failures too? So I do believe where we are here is we know that the government's plans are going to fail. They will always fail. But why should we be bailing them out? Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who suffered how many years in communist concentration camps, he gave us the word gulag to understand the Soviet concentration camps. Solzhenitsyn said, the lie is the pillar of the state. Let your credo be thus. Let the lie come, but not through me. I will not advance the lie. And so one of the best things we can do is just refuse to keep repeating the lies, being part of the system, for us to personally secede. I secede from the government indoctrination system, pull my children out of school and homeschool. I secede from the government indoctrination system, I'm not listening to SATV, ETV, don't care what Clinton News Network, the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation, Slime Magazine, Newspeak, useless news and world reports. We are getting our alternative news, alternative everything. Why should it be part of globalist agenda? So I think the more you can make yourself independent, the better it can work. The world is going to hell in a handbox. We need to build our own future. Yes.
I'm sorry, what about that? That's the right number. Do you still pay tax to government?
Taxes?
Yes.
Okay. Well, here's the principle.
So?
Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what's God's. Now, when Jesus said this, he had to borrow a coin. He didn't have one apparently. And so he asked the people, okay, whose symbol is this on it? Caesar's. Render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what's God's. In other words, give Caesar the coin. Not that he deserves any damn anything, because what has he done? He just gives you grief. But render to God what is God's. Now your children are not made in the image of Caesar. Why should they be rendered to Caesar? And so on. They made in the image of God, and they are entrusted to their parents. So today, the way people teach it is, render unto Caesar everything Caesar demands. And give God your coin. A completely flipped it around. With the whole emphasis of Jesus, if Caesar wants it, you have to. I mean, he deserves a coin about that's it. But give God everything else. And that was the spirit of Christians for years. But now we've got this mentality. Do you know what income tax Americans were paying before the Second World War? Something like 1%. By the end of the Second World War, they were paying 4%, which sounds like this is outrageous. But of course, they had to save the Soviet Union and send all those trillions of weapons over there, so it took more money. But now they're paying, what, 40-something%? And us in South Africa, no. So, look, there's no doubt that the vast amount of your taxes is wasted, squandered, stolen, and looted. According to the African Union, 32% of the gross domestic product is stolen by government taxes. That's the anti-corruption process. 32% of the gross domestic product itself is stolen by government corruption. We're not talking about taxation. We're not talking about inflation. Just state capture theft is 32% of the GDP. It's colossal. So the less you can give them, the better. Now, you know, tax evasion is illegal. Tax avoidance is legal. Tax avoidance means working within the law to avoid paying tax. You set up a trust, you organize whatever's got to be done. So tax avoidance, to do things in such a way that you pay the least tax possible, which I certainly believe in. Government deserves nothing, because they give us nothing but grief. But to stay out of jail, you do what you have to, but you try and organize as much as possible, as much as you can do bartering or avoid the banks and so on. Sorry?
It's called pay.
Yeah, so basically speaking, render unto Caesar what it sees means give Caesar what he deserves, which isn't much. But render unto God what is God's, I mean, that's the balance. And today, The average church is teaching about rendering to Caesar everything he asks for, even if he says your five church services during Easter. Yeah. Like, just do whatever you want. Oh, send me your kids so they can teach them how to be whoremongering, fornicating perverts, and learn the mechanics of how to be, gay GV, thinking gender and all that. We need to be more independent-minded thinking people in that. So, taxes, they use our taxes against us. Even during this lockdown, they've said they're not giving any taxes to anyone who's not BBBEE. So, oh, we can pay the taxes, but we can't get any benefits. The whole system's rigged against us. So, if you can organize your finances in such a way that the government gets as little or as nothing as possible, the better. Yeah? But of course, we don't want to do it in such a way that gives an excuse to them to say, you've been illegal, so. But, you know, for example, when John B. Rockefeller became Vice President of America, he had to go to congressional, this is under Henry Ford, 1974, they were satisfied that the richest man in America hadn't paid any taxes his whole life. And I asked him about it, he says, oh, well, I didn't deal with that, so I wouldn't know about that. And the richest people in this country don't pay taxes. That's why people are amazed when we said the independent case should replace income tax, VAT, GST, and so on, abolish it all, replace with TEAL, total economic activity limit. Economists like Stephen Milton Fritz and says, you don't even need 1%. A quarter of 1% would be sufficient to operate everything. He said, 1% TEAL, total economic activity limit on every bank transaction, doesn't matter about cash, just bank transactions, would get more money in than we get now. What? How's it possible? You're paying like 47%. He said, but the biggest businesses don't pay tax.
Everybody has tax.
But what I'm saying is, under the present system, Anglo American, Old Mutual, the Beers, they are so wrapped up in they paying virtually no tax. But if TEAL is applied across the board, then everybody, even if it's Anglo American, they 1% taken off, you'll get more tax than you're getting now. So right now, the middle class is being led dry.
Yeah.
For a little bit at the top of getting on, but it can be less than that because most of what the government's doing they shouldn't be doing, and most of it's corrupt and efficient and so on. So if you wanted a free country, you would even need a quarter of 1% TEAL and it would be adequate. But this is according, I'm not an economist, that's according to economists like Stephen Milton Fritz. This would solve unemployment and so many things. You don't need the government to pay for anything. When the government runs school, it's been proven a government-controlled education will cost 8 times more per pupil than a private school. Now, it doesn't look that way to us because they're using our taxes, but when you work out that's how much money they put into it, divided by how many students. So, governments will give you free education, but the free education costs 800% more than if you did it yourself, if we weren't being taxed today. You follow the logic. Yes.
I wanted to ask something. This last week, I heard I have people in the financial world saying that South Africa will be facing a sovereign debt claim soon.
Yes.
Our growth rate is going into the minus, like some minus.
We've been the minus for the last 2.5 years.
Yeah, but it's going to be into minus.
Now, under the lockdown, it's plummeting.
We
can't even service the debt.
So, in my mind, we go in the same way as we do in Zimbabwe.
Please don't take the name of Rhodesian vain. Rhodesia never went that way. Zimbabwe went that way.
I used the word Rhodesia because it wasn't Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe.
Yeah, but Rhodesia was a paradise. No, Zimbabwe's a hellhole.
I know. Do you know that in 1973, I toured Rhodesia,
yes,
and we had to exchange rands to Rhodesian dollars, and it cost 1 rand 10 cents. To buy a Rhodesian dollar,
yeah,
in 1973.
Well, in 1977, when my father-in-law went to Rhodesia, it cost $3 American to buy 1 Rhodesian dollar.
Well, there you go.
And 1 Rhodesian dollar could buy you a steak dinner. in Salisbury.
So now, what are my questions? I'm from a financial, from an economic point of view, surely we don't
go this slide. Well, there's no
doubt. We're not going. We've gone over the precipice.
America's.
We are. I mean, if you can go from history, what other African country has ever made it work?
Well, yes, there's no doubt that you cannot loot 32% of the GDP and expect the country to be healthy. And it's not like they're administering the rest of it well. Everything, Eskom, Arms Corp, Telkom, SAA, you name it, every parastatal is parasitical. They are leeching off
on Earth. So we've got our own banking system. So we can pull our economy away. We, most of us on our system is spend tax, because that's all we're going to do in the dispensation is spend tax. And so you can get away with a lot less tax. And within what we're doing at the moment, you can actually, it's not avoid tax.
A tax avoidance. No, tax avoidance is legal. Tax evasion is not.
So we're not going to avoid tax.
Not pay what you have.
Within our system, you can pay people without the government anything, so you don't have to pay.
Well, for example, bartering.
Bartering
is one way
to barter. Inventing money is useless. It's the greatest invention since, I don't know.
Yeah, no, but the point is, you don't have to work through the rank.
Yes,
that's the point. As long as we have our currency and we know that we use it,
the fact is, if the government's not giving you anything, then there's no services you need to pay them for. Rates and taxes are meant to be for services rendered. Now, if they're not protecting you, and they're not providing for you, and they're not giving you everything that you need, electricity, well, then why do you need to pay them if you're not getting services? So it's fair enough that if you are benefiting from a system, you should contribute to the system. But the present system is so organized that they take from you, but they don't give anything back except greed. So that's what R.W. Johnson says, the Cape will secede, because there'll no longer be any benefit. And this is like an abused spouse trying to avoid an abusive relationship. Nobody wants divorce. Divorce isn't nice, but sometimes it's the only option in an abusive relationship. And so in this case, we're talking about a divorce from South Africa, when the South African government hates us. And in fact, when the leader of the country can take part in singing to kill us, then you know, really, it's really a blame us for everything. And then even say, we will be giving this kind of lockdown aid to our people. And they say, thank you, say, oh, but not you. You're not our people.
You are sitting at the table with.
You're not our people.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, no farmers have been killed in South Africa. That's fine. But Cyril Ramaphosa, he didn't become a billionaire by hard work. He became a billionaire by BBBEE. Give us free shares, and he just kept a few more for himself than he gave to other citizens.
The other thing I wanted to say was, in this week, I researched it, and they say that America's problems are
serious.
Catastrophic. We're going to be catastrophic to the extent that the dollar is going, the dollar, which is the world,
well, it's been the medium of exchange.
The dollar will stand. And if they say that precious metals like gold, silver,
you're going to go back to gold.
So our government will loot all the gold and silver.
Yeah.
They got to loot it.
Sorry, let's have one question. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's not fair for us to be paying taxes when we're not getting services. So there's nothing wrong with avoiding paying taxes, but you've got to do it in a legal way.
Yeah.